So this talk is called Insight and Perception. So the reason why I wanted to give it really is I think it's quite important to keep thinking about the Buddhist teachings and keep thinking about the different terms that are there, you know, that we see quite often, you know. So the particular Buddhist term I'm going to focus on tonight is something called Samnya, which is the Sanskrit, or Sanya, S-A-N-N-A, in Pali, which is often translated as perception. So it's there, you know, it's there in the five skandhas, one of the skandhas. And the origin of this train of thought was that I came across, I was looking at a book called Mindfulness in Early Buddhism. And the author, who's a Taiwanese monk called Seifu Xuan, he was talking about the mechanism of that takes place, that he thought, with the metta bhavana. So he said that the metta bhavana is a process of constructive imagination. So it's like we're bringing mindfulness to our samnya, to our apperceptions of things, to make them more in line with reality. So the basic idea behind that was, if we're thinking of ourselves as an object, you know, so apperception is, it's often translated as something like recognition. The way it works is, I mean, Vishwapani corrected me on this. I used to call it, think it was perception. So basically what it is once you've learned what an object is called, you know, so you learn what a chair is at school, then when you next see a chair, you go, oh, it's a chair. You know, so you recognise it as that. We build up a way of recognising everything. So it's quite important, like, that we recognise things correctly. You know, so when we see a human being, that we recognise them as a human being with feelings and everything like that, not as an object. So, but what, I think what happens is that samnya becomes kind of like deluded, or it changes all the time. We become unmindful of what's really there, and we start seeing human beings as objects. Now when I teach the metta bhavana, I'm often working like this. I'm sort of saying, okay, so you've got a view, and you've got your mind, in the full sense of it, as your psyche. And part of that mind is your emotions. You know, so your view conditions your emotions. So if you think, oh, that's an object there, you'll have a, when you see a human being, you'll be indifferent towards them. That'll be your emotion. And if you see a human being and you really recognise them as a human being, and everything that is implied in that, then you'll tend to want to respond with care towards them, because that's the appropriate emotional response. And this works with everything, really. So, you know, often our view is often the thing that we think is going to bring happiness, you know, we have a view about things, and we protect it, think, yeah, this is what I need to do. So if our view is like, you know, stuffing our face with cream cakes is going to bring us happiness, that's what we'll do, you know, our emotion will be to want them. If it's to push everybody away out of our way, that's what we'll do. You know, that, we can think that brings us happiness. So in that book, I thought, oh yeah, that's great. That really helps solve the problem of like what emotions are, because people often think in terms of emotions as somehow to do with feelings. So here we've got like body, feeling, mind, chitta, and views, mental objects, the four foundations of mindfulness. So if we, you know, we can think of emotions as feeling, but feeling is just pleasant or painful. It's not something we're doing. So in any emotion, there's a contribution from the body, there's a contribution from feeling, and there's a contribution from a view, from our views about things. So it's like just trying to make sure our perceptions are in line with how things are really helps our emotions be in line with how things are appropriate. So, so I was putting this in your book and everything, and then after a while it kind of dawned on me that I wonder if that operates in other areas, in meditation, you know, the thing about our perception being transformed through mindfulness. So what about the mindfulness of breathing? So, you know, what are you trying to do in the mindfulness of breathing? So when I, these days, often when I teach it, I'll talk about the object not particularly being the breath, because the aim of the meditation is to cultivate awareness, is to cultivate mindfulness. So in a way, that's the object. The object is more mindfulness. But the breath is like a vehicle to that. So if you think, oh, how do I cultivate mindfulness through watching the breath? Well, if I'm trying to know whether I know what's happening with the breath or not, you know, like detail in the breath, do I know what's happening now and then the next moment and all that? If I can say, yeah, I do know what just happened then, and in that moment as well, in that moment, then we can say that we're being mindful. But if we're just vague about it, we can't really say that. So the object is mindfulness, really, in the meditation. Now, when we start doing the meditation, when we sit down, or before we do a meditation course or something, we might think, oh yeah, I'm perfectly mindful. So our sanya about our awareness is one thing. You know, we think we're aware. What we recognise in ourselves is we think we're aware. Once we start to bring mindfulness to this, you know, through meditating on it, what do we realise then after a while? We're not aware. You know, we're not with the breath at all. So the process of bringing mindfulness to our perception about our awareness actually helps us improve it. You know, so we'll think, oh, I'm not really being mindful. I need to be more mindful. It was interesting in the Bangor University, secular mindfulness dialogue that sort of evolved around mindfulness, and they were going, people were talking as if it was automatic that when you practice mindfulness that you just became mindful, But Buddhists were going, hang on a minute, no. The point is that often you become aware how unmindful you are. So this sort of explains that a little bit. Do you think that makes sense? Explain it clearly. So Four Foundations of Mindfulness, chitta is mind, in the sense of the whole psyche. And I think the reason why it's the whole psyche is it's like what we're looking at here is everything that is active and has an effect in the world. So that has a karmic effect. So our emotions have a karmic effect. Our thoughts have a karmic effect. And our degree of attention has a karmic effect as well. So we work on our emotions in the metta bhavana, we work on our attention in the mindfulness of breathing, and then we work on our thoughts in insight meditation. We work to change our view of things. So our view is just what we happen to have. We'll have a particular view of things at any moment, that's just the view at the time, at that time. But because these two condition each other, if we think about something, we can change our view. We don't have to think about it, If we're happy with our view, then we probably don't need to think about it. But if another view comes along, that's somebody else's view, or if we have a better view, we have to think about it. We have to think, oh, is that right, or is that right? So you have the active side of the mind, which is thinking, and then you have the sort of almost the static side of the mind, which is the view that is actually held. And this here, this foundation is dharmas, which is mental objects. And in Bhante's translation of the Heart Sutta, he translates dharmas as what the mind takes hold of. So it's like, it's like that. It's like what the view that the mind has at a particular time. And that's it, I think this covers everything really. Emotions, thoughts and attention. So we have the same process again with apperception and mindfulness, bringing mindfulness to our apperceptions. And when we're thinking about views. And this is insight meditation. That's a nice agreement. So again, we start off at the beginning of the meditation before we do the insight meditation, thinking, I'm really clear that everything's impermanent, and don't need any help with that, really. So we then sit down and we do an insight meditation. So we sort of drop in the idea that things are impermanent, and I think the idea behind you've got the three levels of wisdom. You've got wisdom through hearing, which is just when you hear something, you go, oh yeah, that makes sense. wisdom through reflection, and the last one is wisdom through meditating. So I think that wisdom through meditating is where whatever you've reflectively accepted, which is what happens at level two. Ratnaguna talks about this, you know, reflective acceptance. Yeah, I agree with that. Actually goes right down to the, you know, depths of your being, you know, so you act as if that's the case. So there's no thinking smoking's a bad idea and then having one. It's like you think smoking's a bad idea and you don't have any ever, you know. So it's like there's something about it's just integrated right down to the lowest level, really. So yeah, so when you do any kind of meditation on an insight topic like impermanence, I think again, it just you bring mindfulness to what you recognise, and you just realise that actually you're not really into that at all. You know, you're not really as clear about it or able to sort of sit with it as you thought. But that's good. You know, it's like self-knowledge, isn't it? Yeah. Know thyself. And I think, you know, it's why you have the idea of Socrates being the wisest person in Athens, because he didn't think he was wise. He just was aware of what he didn't, how much he didn't know, really.
You described it as recognition.
Yeah.
And then you said, you say, for example, in the process of insight meditation, you then realise. And I just wondered what the relationship is between recognition and realisation, maybe with a small r or bigger.
Well, that's an interesting point. I think if you, you know, if you recognise something as how things are one minute, you think, oh yeah, you know, things are impermanent, all that. But then 5 minutes later, you're not recognising that at all. You're thinking something else. You know, when your samyas doing something else, it's going, oh yeah, no, it's all right. Then it's not really stable, is it? You know, it's not really stable samyā. Yeah. Whereas if it's just there all the time, then that's a sign that it, you know, it's realised. You know, yeah. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So does it link then with the idea of right view or perfect view and mundane views?
Yeah.
Is that the difference?
Yeah. I was going to talk about that. Funny. Yeah. But thanks. Yeah, so I'll just say a little bit about right view. Sagramati's our kind of one of our former scholars in the movement. And I'm a bit of a fan of his, you know. And last year he was doing quite a few days for order members. And he did one on right view, and I've got Kamachi here to send up the audio recording so I can listen to it. And it's really interesting what he's saying about right view. So right view. So you've got the in the path to nirvana. So this is nirvana. You've got a point that Sangharakshita talks about as the point of no return. Or traditionally known as stream entry. So this is the point where your momentum in spiritual practice has got to be so much that you've got enough momentum to get to nirvana. But short of that, you haven't, you might fall back again. So, what Sagramati sort of said, talked about was like, at this point, at stream entry, you have what's called right view. So it's a bit like, I suppose, if you're driving a car and you've got the, you know where you're going, you've got the map, you know the direction to go if you're going in. You obviously need that too if you're going to get to your destination of nirvana. At stream entry, it said that you've still got like up to 7 lifetimes left before you're going to attain nirvana. And you have other stages, like the stage of the once returner, so you're going to get reborn once more, and the non-returner, before you get to the stage of the arahant. So, in the at the point of stream entry, you've broken 3 fetters. So you've broken fixed self view. So you don't think of yourself as like unchanging. Which you're obviously going to need that if you're going to get, if you're going to change. You've got doubt, which isn't a kind of rational doubt like, oh yeah, I don't really believe that. It's more of a sort of emotional wavering or something. So you've got faith, basically. And you've got dependence on rites and rituals as ends in themselves. So, you're not going through the motions, basically. Yeah. You're not just practicing because everybody else is practicing. And then you've got 10 fetters altogether that are broken at nirvana. So you've got them. This is here. And then the next level, you've got you weaken craving and hatred. And then here, you break, you've rid of craving and hatred at the non-return. And then you've got 3 other ones like conceit and ignorance and slight wavering or something. So the point here is that you've still got work to do beyond stream entry to kind of transform your emotions. And when Sagramati talks about a view, he talks about it as a deeply ingrained attitude. Which includes your emotions, which includes your deepest emotions. So you might have a conscious part to your view. I think smoking's a bad idea. And then you've got all your emotions underneath, and fears and desires. The sort of fear like you don't really want to be exposed to what happens when you stop smoking emotionally, or the pain of it, or if you're revealing your actual experience, stuff like that. So this is all the really powerful stuff that needs to be transformed before you are brought in line with nirvana, with reality, before you're going to get there, really. There's a term, anusaya, which means latent tendencies. So So this is like this, this is these things that are there down there under the surface that are kind of will keep coming up all the time. So you've got three kind of things really. You've got Nirvana here, it's rudimentary there, and this is zero. So this is, and at Nirvana, a synonym for it is knowledge of the destruction of the Arshavas. So Arshavas, or biases. So these are a tendency to look for happiness in sense desire. So you're no longer seeking happiness in the world of the senses. It's not like you don't enjoy enjoy sensory experience, but you don't. It's not a refuge because it's impermanent. This is karma, karma sugar. And then you've got bhava sugar, which is bhava means becoming or existence. You don't have any kind of preference for one form of existence over another, you don't. And then finally you've got arvid ashava, which is ignorance, any tendency to ignorance. So what we have is at stream entry we've got right view with ashavas, and at nirvana we've got right view without ashavas. And all this is saying is it's like, there's this work to be done on converting the depths of our psyche, from between stream entry and nirvana. And in terms of Sangharakshita's teaching on going for refuge, what you have is different levels of going for refuge. So you have a provisional going for refuge, which is where you go for refuge under certain conditions, and then you might stop going for refuge under the change. You've got effective going for refuge, which is the level of an older member. So you will hopefully carry on going for refuge, you've got enough momentum to do that in your life. You won't give up. And then you've got real going for refuge, which is this level here, stream entry. So here, you can still fall back here, but you do have quite a bit of momentum. There you can't fall back. So all older members are trying to get from effective to real going for refuge, where basically you're guaranteed nirvana. And then you've got absolute going for refuge and nirvana. So I think that's pretty much all I've got to say, but I could take questions or could have a discussion if you like.
So working with the ashravas, what's the implication for meditation practice?
Yeah, so your question is like, with the ashravas, what's the implication for meditation practice? Well, I think they are tied in with meditation practice. So, so in the description of the Buddha's path to Nirvana, it says, you know, it says that he entered into the first dhyana, which is in seclusion from sensuality and unskillful mental states. So it's basically it's a dhyana is a skillful mental state, and it's not relying on the world of the senses for satisfaction. So you have what you have is two types of feeling that are described in the Satipatthana Sutta. You've got worldly feeling and you've got spiritual feeling. So worldly feeling arises in dependence on the five chords of sense desire. So it's basically attachment to anything within the world of the senses. And then spiritual feeling arises in the dhyanas. So it arises out of skillfulness only. And being arising out of skillfulness, it has no downside to it. It doesn't create any harm. So for instance, if you care for somebody and you see them doing well and you feel pleased, then that has no negative consequence. You know. If you see somebody suffering and it's painful to you and you act on it, it has a positive consequence. It has no negative consequence. So all spiritual feeling has no negative consequence, whereas to follow a worldly feeling, it has a negative consequence. So you get attached to pleasures, you create suffering through pushing things away, you know, through aversion and all that. So I'd say, you know, that this ashrava, the calm ashrava, the one to do with sense desire, in a way it's at the boundary between non-dhyanic experience and dhyanic experience. And then the bhava-shiva, so you, in the dhyanas, I think you can see them as representing increasingly skillful mental states. So the second dhyana has the tone of inspiration. You know, it's like this uprising, upwelling joy. You know, so it's a bit like it's like you're being skillful, but your emotions are really involved in it. Like you're joyful about the skillfulness. You know, you're over the moon that your friend is doing well. And then in the third dhyana, that joyfulness sort of calms down, and you're just left with a kind of deep peacefulness. And in the descriptions of the spiral path, you often have joy, pacification, bliss, and the pacification bit is often linked with different qualities arising in the mind, like mental pliability, buoyancy of mind, ethical uprightness. So it's like the mind is really becoming skillful, you know, it's being moulded in that way. It's not just being skillful and falling back again. It's like it's being shaped in that, as being skillful all the time, you know, as naturally being skillful. And then in the fourth dhyana, that's all the same, that's all present, that same thing. But there's no... that isn't influenced at all by whether your experience is pleasurable or painful. So the danger in the third dhyana is like you get a bit carried away, you go, oh, I feel great, oh, that sort of thing. So it's a distraction potentially. When equanimity comes in the fourth dhyana, then it's got this spiritual strength to it. It's going to keep going no matter what, in terms of being skillful. And in the description of the dhyanas, it talks about, well, there's the two words, pariyodhata, which means completely, it's like white or something. It's like, I think odhata is white or something. So it's like completely white. So you often get this associated with like white light, the white light of the Dhammadhatu or the white light of reality or something like that. I think it's just it's almost like a unblemishable state of mind that's just really bright. And sudhi or something. It's got sudhi in it, so it's pure, so it's completely pure. And I think what it means is it's completely skillful, which is probably the pure bit, and it's completely immune to being stained, or it's not going to it's going to be able to take reality in. I think that's it, really, because often that white light is the white light appears in the bardo, and you recoil from it. But if your mind is in that pariyodhata state, then it won't do that. It'll go, oh yeah, I accept this. So I think there might be some connection here between with the Bhavashrava in this at this place, where you're at the top of the fourth dhyana, and then you kind of you have no preference for one type of experience or another. It's like that image of the sphere being balanced on a plane. It's not going to go anywhere. It makes sense, that, I think. Logical sense. And then, you get around all this, you get all sorts of cosmologies evolve, where you have the gods are represented as being in here. Beyond the fourth dhyana, you get like supernormal powers arising, float through the air and all that sort of thing. And I think, for me, I think the Buddha, when he talks about supernormal powers, he says you shouldn't dismiss them, but neither should you get carried away by them. So he criticised people for saying, for saying you can do without them, because in a way, they're symbolic of like powerful states that you can get into, but you don't get in. But likewise, you don't get obsessed with trying to get into supernormal states, because that's really unhelpful and is a distraction. So. Any other questions?
I was wondering about with the Bhavasana and related to dhyana, because one of the remaining five fetters from that anaha breaks is not favouring a form of existence or a formless existence, formless existence being in the dhyanas. It seems to that those fetters are directly related to the dhyana. So wouldn't Bhavasana mean, removing any preference for any dhyana state, including like the formless dhyanas and the original four?
Yeah, well, I think I think, well, when the, you know, said the Buddha could just move at will from first dhyana to the fourth dhyana.
Yeah.
So it's like he's not, if he had some preference for one or the other, he would tend to get pulled in that direction, wouldn't he?
Yeah.
So I think, yeah, that's the state you want to get into, where you can choose one thing or another.
Yeah. That's one thing that you mentioned about how dhyana don't really have any negative aspects to the skillful mental states, but in my years of being a Buddhist and hanging around meditators, you do get the dhyana junkies, the people who are kind of like constantly after the next dhyana or the try to spend as much time in dhyana as possible, and
partly why you have the teaching of five spiritual faculties. So you've got concentration on the one hand, it has to be balanced with energy in pursuit of the good, or virya, on the other. So you have to test the fact that, you know, are you robust enough to go out into the world and just do an ordinary job?
Yeah.
You know, so if you're a jhana junkie, you know, you're probably going to have to say no. You know? So it's like, yeah. And in a way, the fourth dhyana is a bit like that, isn't it? It's like you've developed equanimity, so you are robust. You know, I think equanimity is like being skillful under all circumstances. So it's like you don't change your mind about being skillful just because things are a bit painful or something like that. So
can I just say something?
Yeah.
You know, when you're happy. You could always wait for something to go wrong, haven't you? Something.
Yeah.
And I just wondered, it's been there. It's an age old thing, really, isn't it?
Yeah.
You think more than one burst or something.
Yeah.
You're too happy or something.
Yeah. Well, like happiness being sort of something you can be afraid of losing.
Yeah.
Thing, yeah. So. So that's there in the teaching on dukkha. So one form of dukkha is direct suffering, but another form is, I can't remember the name for it now, but it's like where you're experiencing pleasure, but you're afraid of it going away, you know. I came across a sutta that I can't remember the name of it now, but it basically talks about the there being like 11 ways to something like 11 ways to attain nirvana, and so there are things like you get into one of the four dhyanas, and then you reflect that those states are conditioned and volitionally produced. So it's a bit like you're sort of saying, well, you're admitting that they're impermanent, you know. So when something you says you really know, you're fully convinced that they are conditioned and volitionally produced. So you're really convinced that whatever skillful mental state you bring about, or whatever good thing you bring into the world, it isn't going to last. So, you know, you don't then get depressed about it when it goes, or when the object that you've created goes, or the effect you've created goes. And I think for me, this is how skillfulness and insight are connected, that the insight is just that. And it's like things come fall apart, therefore, you know, one has to keep bringing them into being all the time. Like, perpetual self-transcendence. So nirvana is not a static state that you get into and then rest. It's like, it's a state that you get into where you really realise that on a deep level, that everything just ends and will come to an end. If, you know, so you're looking for the conditions to maintain that. And maintain whatever's positive. So, and one of the conditions is that realisation. So, yeah.
That kind of feels sort of when, just thinking kind of logically, then you're earlier on the path, so you're directing effort to create conditions, you know, skillful conditions or skillful context, and plus, you know, the practice of ethics. So it's not necessarily just thinking, you know, whether it's the stages that you put, you know, provisional sort of round sort of effective, but there's a direct, almost like a willful effort to create conditions, which feels kind of different from an awakening mind, where there be, well, there is simply the spontaneity of play, of the show, of life.
Well, there's that word dharmata, which means naturalness, and Ratnagunas talks about this a bit, that you don't, it's not through an act of will that things arise, you know. So you don't, it gives the example of like freedom from remorse doesn't arise through an act of will, you know. It arises naturally when a person's ethics is kind of complete, you know. So if your ethics are full and everything, it's just natural that you feel remorse when you do something wrong. And I think all of the path is like this, you know. So it's just natural that when you stop creating negative conditions like the hindrances, you know. So if you get your body into a good state, so it's got vitality in it, and your mind is clear and sharp and everything, you won't have that muddiness of mind. You won't have sloth and torpor and all, you know. But you put the work in to get there, and you're maintaining it, you know. Then you're naturally in better conditions to be skillful, because you can think clearly. And you've got the energy in your body to support your mind and your emotions and all that. So I think everything's a bit like that, really. You know, the Buddha wouldn't keep making mistakes about what leads to what. He would be very clear that, no, it's precisely this that is the thing that I have to keep doing, and not be. And his samnya wouldn't keep changing. You know, thinking one thing one minute and something else the next. You know, so. Yeah. So it's 5 to 8. So shall we have a 20-minute tea break and then come back and do the puja?
Great. Yeah. Thanks a lot.